Desi, noun. A person of Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, Nepali, or Sri Lankan origin who lives abroad.
American Desi. Well, that's what we hope to discover here. What's up, everybody? Welcome to American Desis. I'm Akash.
I'm Arjun.
And today we have with us a very special guest. We have with us a filmmaker, director. He's doing all kinds of stuff. We'll just let him tell you about it. Let's welcome to the show Gautam Chopra.
Hey. Woo! Wow. Thank you guys for having me.
I did that because he's a big sports fan. You all can't see him right now, but he's sitting here with a backwards Boston Red Sox fan hat on. And, that's actually the main... He's got his Tom Brady framed jersey over there. I'm assuming that you're a big, big Boston fan.
I'm a total masshole, as we like to call ourselves, grew up there. And while I don't really get back there much, I have maintained loyalty to my team.
You a big Bill Simmons fan?
I am. I mean, in reading Bill, I feel we're kind of the same generation, so I know everything he's talking about. Yeah.
And you get to read a homer on a national level, which you don't often get to do.
Yeah, no, he's kind of made it legit. So yeah.
He blatantly started cheering when they drafted Marcus Smart. That was one of my favorite moments of the draft. He just face pumped.
Yeah.
And then was like, oops, I can't do that. What, which brings us, really, we wanted to dive right in. Because you had a big year. Two documentaries coming out that came out both in 2015 about two legendary sports figures.
Yeah.
One from the U.S. and one from India.
Muse about Kobe Bryant and The Little Master about Sachin Tendulkar.
Tell us, how did those projects both come about?
Well, first of all, I mean, I'm a huge sports fan, as you guys have already noted. While I never intended to sort of go or pursue a career kind of in sports, it's just sort of naturally something that I've always been obsessed with. So in the case of Sachin, cricket has always been this thing I've vaguely been familiar with by virtue of being, Indian, connected to India. And, my whole childhood growing up, going back and forth to India, cricket was the thing. And I'd say,
did you play?
I mean, I played when I went there, like to visit my grandparents with all my cousins and stuff like that. But I never really followed it. I mean, there really wasn't much. There still isn't much of a cricket culture here in the States. But, I sort of was familiar with it. And then over the last literally like 20 years, there's been this one guy that you always used to hear about.
Yeah.
So I was sort of, I've always, you already mentioned Bill Simmons. I've always been a huge fan of the 30 for 30 franchise on ESPN. Yeah. And I'd gotten to know those guys a little bit. And I kept on trying to convince them like, hey, there's this sport out there and there's this athlete out there that you guys need to, like, if you're, the worldwide leader in sports, then you got to, deal
so this
with
it. Because that was one of our questions. How were you the one that was actively pitching? Because this year also, they had the new Cricket World, app that both of us bought. We were watching cricket on it. It was like an infusion. It was like now it was on their homepage about cricket things.
Yeah. I mean, my process with them started like 2 years before that, in terms of just, hey,
so you're the guy who bought cricket to America.
Yeah. There it is.
I like to think of it. Yes. That way. I just sort of, again, Connor Schell, who's, Bill's executive producing partner at ESPN Films, he, somebody I knew through a, sort of network of people. So I kept on telling Connor, this is something, and they were open to it from day one. We just had to find that kind of angle. And Sachin was sort of the angle, here's this one person in this one sport in this far off place of the world that you've never really heard of, but is bigger than anyone else.
Right.
And so, that was something like even if you don't know anything about cricket, but you're part of the culture of sports, then you can appreciate that. And that sort of became our way in.
Right. And then you also have the Kobe Bryant documentary. Muse.
Yeah, I mean, look, Kobe's like the opposite, right? Like, if you grew up in this country, he is, a cultural icon. Kobe transcends sports. And I'm a huge Celtics fan. I grew up, so I spent most of my life hating Kobe Bryant.
Yeah, I hate him too. This documentary made me really begrudgingly respect him.
Yeah. I hated Kobe, but I sort of met Kobe a couple of years ago more informally than anything.
Right.
And, started to sort of become, I don't even want to say become friends with him, became friendly with him and had some shared passions. Obviously, my passion for basketball and my love of basketball, despite my hatred for the Lakers, is something. I mean, Kobe's the ultimate basketball geek. So, you know, he knows everything about everything, including every, he knows the Celtics backwards and forwards.
Right.
We was talking about the Chicago Bulls player, James, was it Bullet? What was his name? James.
John Battle.
Yeah. Was like, yeah. He even said in things, he's like, you're not going to know about it, but that's someone that I learned from.
Yeah. No, he is the ultimate basketball aficionado. I mean, and that was my favorite part of working on the film, was just being able to hang with Kobe and talk about, you know, not only the NBA today, but you can talk about the 80s, the 70s, the 60s, the 50s. He knows stuff about George Mikan, and like he'll watch game tape with you, you know, from the very earliest days, and sort of point out things.
How did Muse come about?
So I had met Kobe a couple years ago, like more at a charity thing here in LA, and I just sort of got to talking to him. You know, we had a shared friend in common. When I was growing up, I knew Michael Jackson, and Kobe got to know Michael, obviously, when he arrived in LA and was a huge superstar. And so we had some funny anecdotes we shared about Michael, and that sort of became a point of bonding. And then, you know, Kobe also has always had this obsession with, like, what makes greatness? Like, why? What made Michael Jackson Michael Jackson? You know, all these people. So that's something I've always sort of been fascinated with, and we talked a lot about that. And that became the seed of an idea that only really had shape when Kobe got hurt now almost 2 years ago. And he had always told me, like, I want to do a documentary. I want to write a book. I want to do something to talk about this. And I never, as a storyteller, as a filmmaker, knew what the structure for that was until he got hurt. And then I kind of called him. In fact, I was in India working on the Sachin thing when I saw, you know, it on Twitter that, like, Kobe had gotten hurt. And I think I texted him later that night and said, hey, I have an idea, like, we should follow your comeback, because he said in the locker room 45 minutes later, I'm coming back.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, like, that, we can follow that, and then in the, you know, with that as the spine, we can talk about all this other stuff, this pursuit.
Just like
greatness.
To note how casually we're talking about Michael Jackson.
That's what I'm saying. The only time we've ever not had anything to say was when he said he was friends with Michael Jackson, and we just both processed that for a second. So there's a lot of things I wanted to ask you about. Michael Jackson, we can talk about off air, I guess. But these two people, Sachin and Kobe, seem so diametrically opposed. Kobe seems so aggressive in terms of, like, I'm going to be great. I'm going to demolish everybody who steps in my path. He said that on the documentary. Sachin seems so humble and, like, you know, I'm leaving tickets for the super fans and, like, I'm about the people. What was it like to study those two different people? Second of all, does it seem like Kobe is kind of America embodied the spirit, and Sachin is kind of India embodied the spirit? I thought of that question just now, everybody. Killing it.
Well, sorry, because I'm going to have to sort of diffuse that question. First of all, I will say, like, I've gotten to know Kobe way better. You know, I spent a couple of hours with Sachin. Obviously, I followed him and I studied him. But I've spent, I mean, hours upon hours upon hours, days upon days. I've traveled, you know, to China and back with Kobe and gone to games and just really gotten to know Kobe really well. And so, you know, I think one of the interesting things about, and the way you describe them, is, yes, they're very dissimilar in some ways, but they're also really alike. Like, Sachin has a competitiveness that boils within him, and you talk to everyone around him, and even the more you talk to him, especially about the game, he is so competitive and fiery. You know, he doesn't show it outwardly, but, you know, you don't achieve that level of kind of superstardom without having that ferocity.
Some of those earlier clips that you showed of Sachin, where he was just, and they talked about how it was a genteel game. I think it was Wright Thompson that was talking about how it was such a genteel game, and then he came in and he was very brash with it.
Yeah.
I mean, he was hitting sixes, like, crushing the ball. There was an aggression to him.
There was an aggression, and I think, you know, Sachin, like, he was this guy who arrived on the scene. I mean, cricket's such a fascinating game, right? Because it's embedded with so much narrative, like colonial legacy and stuff like that.
Yeah. Right.
So Sachin came at a time also when India was sort of in this, you know, post-colonial transformation and really growing and had a lot of pride. And Sachin was that guy that was all funneled through. Plus, he was amazing. He was amazing at what he did. I was going to say, and then likewise, like, Kobe, who's so outwardly aggressive, and certainly, you know, again, if you're a basketball fan, you see that Black Mamba, like, super aggressive side of him. But there is also a side of him that is really humble and really sort of contemplative and thoughtful and curious. You know, it's sort of the side that exists off the basketball court, but there's, like, an element of Sachin in him. And so I think in that way, like, it's interesting. And I think I've seen it now in a lot of athletes, especially at that elite level. They have to create, like, sort of dual identities. They're these superhero characters that, you know, can exist and be really brash on the field, on the court, on the pitch or whatever. But then also, you know, they're family men. They're quiet. Like, they have lives, and they can't have that same aggression off the court, because otherwise it's very destructive.
One of the most interesting parts of Muse for me, one of the moments, was him talking about when he came to that middle school, and he was his lone, and how basketball became his outlet for all of his rage. And it was like, oh, there was that little scary little boy in there, truthfully. And that's where a lot of that persona, initially, I'm not saying that now, I mean, I don't know him at all, but like, that's where it felt like, oh, wow. And he treated it like this was his art.
Sure.
In a way that was really, really, that was the thing that made me be like, oh, wow, you are some next level shit right there, Kobe.
You know, again, I can say, just in my experience with a lot of elite athletes, that they have a gift and an ability to take, like, this emotion. And usually it is like frustration, rage, anger, or they feel some chip on their shoulder and then funnel it into their play. And so Kobe's like a master at it, but right. There's other guys. I mean, I'm going to name drop again, but like, you know, Tom Brady has that chip on his shoulder. Like, totally. He is, you know, I think I'm a homer when it comes to Brady, but like, he is, I think, the greatest quarterback of all times, but he's still, when you talk to him, he still thinks of himself as, oh no, that guy who, you know, including the Patriots, like, passed over six times, you know, and he still holds on to that, and it drives him and it motivates him. And, you know, these guys have a way of taking that edge and funneling it into their play.
Right. I lost my question for a second.
We were talking about the idea that potentially, like, Kobe represents some aspect of India, and then Sachin represents some aspect of India. Kobe represents some aspect of America, or America and Sachin as India. One of the things that they talked about in the documentary was old India versus new India. Now, I'm curious what you know, it's interesting that sports became this metaphor. Sachin plays the game differently than Virat Kohli.
Yeah.
I mean, and just presentation-wise, I mean, Virat Kohli, who is potentially our next superstar, he tattooed up, hair up, bearded, dating actresses, like, just in some ways different ways. And I'm wondering if you see that there is a shift happening.
Well, I think Sachin was a transitional character from an old India to a new India. Yeah, Virat is new India. I think that, and new India is still kind of figuring itself out, finding. Oh. But Sachin was the guy who sort of bridged it. You know, he was there for 20 plus years. 22. And so he was this guy who had the sort of gentility of the old guard, the old sport and all that stuff, but also the sort of brashness and the worldliness of New India. I mean, New India, I was there 2 days ago, is so kind of unwieldy still. And it's kind of, you know, I always love to say about India, like, you can say anything about it and it's true.
Yeah.
Because India's a lot of everything and too much of it, you know? So it's unclear. I was also while the documentary is really about the 2011 World Cup, when I was there filming it, it was the 2013 IPL. And the IPL is sort of like this symbol of New India. Right. And kind of, I mean, it's just so fascinating. You know, not only in the way the sport has transformed this, like, T20, not to get into the rules of cricket, but also with, like, the culture that is formed around it, with, like, huge stadiums and fans and cheerleaders and all that craziness. Right.
This is what I wanted to ask you, actually, about the documentary. So, about Kobe. So Kobe is kind of fueled by hostility, for lack of a better word, aggression, animosity, I guess. How does that jibe with a Hindu who was raised so spiritual? How did that register with you? We're kind of raised to, like, take everything in and not lash out like that. How did that register with you?
Well, I mean, this is a much bigger discussion about, like, Hinduism. And I, you know, while I've grown up culturally Hindu, like, I guess, like a lot of us in this country, I never really identified myself as, like, I'm a Hindu. I never really considered myself very religious, you know.
Right.
Culturally, yes. And I'm very familiar. I grew up, like, on all the Hindu mythology and stuff like that, which, you know, I sort of work in also now. But I think one of the things that's sort of interesting and often gets overlooked in Hinduism is that, you know, Hinduism embraces all these different aspects of humanity. Sure. So while there is, yes, the sort of benevolent gods, there's also the ferocity of the Kalis and the, you know, the just like all the myths of like just the rage of these gods and all the different aspects. So, I mean, I look at people like Kobe and not to further deify them, which we do too much of in our culture, but you know, Kobe is a basketball genius. He is an artist at what he does, and in a way,
yeah,
you know, he is able to take sort of the divine energies on the one side, but also like these rageful and sort of channel them into his art. And to me, that is, I mean, that is, that's spiritual. I mean, I actually look at Kobe, and I sort of discuss this with my dad all the time. I'm like, you know, Kobe is an incredibly spiritual person because he's able to take all these different emotions and elements of himself and channel it into his dharma, right?
Right.
And he's the best at what he does. So that's incredibly, you know, spiritual to me.
I want to ask about, you talked about that you didn't identify as a Hindu necessarily, religiously. How do you identify in the spectrum of Indian and American?
I mean, you know, it's interesting because I've grown up in a family that I think outwardly people sort of think of as very spiritual and if not, you know, very Eastern Hindu. So there's that side of me, but you know, I'm very Western. I grew up in this country. I consider myself American. I'm very proud of my Indian heritage. I go back every year, you know, my family, I have tons of family there, grandparents, cousins, I'm in touch with them all the time. But if you ask me, I'm American. I mean, I grew up in this country. I feel American. And now, you know, I'm part of a generation that is sort of changing like on the fly. I'm married to a Chinese American woman. You know, my kid is, we call him like the Chindian American. He's the master race, you know, like, and you know, so I don't even know that I know truly how to articulate it. Other than to say, like, I'm very comfortable with who I am and all the different aspects of me. I mean, if you guys look around my house, like, it's, you know, it's this sort of cultural fusion, Indian art, but a lot of it's modern Indian art. It's one of the fascinating things about India right now is how it is also growing, how it is evolving, how it is becoming more globalized. And I embrace that. I think it's, you know, a really fascinating time to be, you know, South Asian.
Now, to the point of you feeling American, your birth name is Gautam, mm-hmm. and now you went by Gautam. Was that something you did just to make it easy for other people, or was it kind of like a thing like, oh, I'm American?
Yeah, no, well again, you know, like, there's not much thought behind most of what I do. Like, there's not in terms of much strategy.
Don't believe you.
Okay, no, but I'll tell you the backstory on that. Like, so, you know, my first job out of college was I worked for this company called Channel One, where, it was still to this day the
in
best.
New York?
The best. No, it was based here in Los Angeles. So Channel One, which has changed a lot now, but is a news network that broadcasts in schools all over the country. So I had this incredible opportunity at the age of like 22 years old to, you know, basically become a foreign correspondent for this news network, which most people had never heard of. And all of a sudden I was traveling all over the world, including India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, mostly to conflict areas and covering these crazy war zones.
Wow.
And so, you know, I've always pronounced my name Gautam, and so, but it was spelled Gautam, which is, you know, the name is spelled all sorts of different ways in India. But so when I was doing on-air stuff, and it was spelled that way, but people had a hard time pronouncing it. But then when I would say Gautam, they'd be like, oh, like Gotham City. So like Gautam. So I was like, yeah, pretty much. That's how I spelled it. So someone said, well, you should just change it, because that's cool, first of all, like for television, and if it's how you pronounce it, and then people pronounce it the right way. And I kind of resisted it, because I think, like, at that age, you know, sort of just coming out of college and having this more South Asian identity, you know, I really resisted it. But I remember, actually, I had a conversation with my dad, and my dad's like, look, I mean, I felt like it was selling out in some way.
Right.
And my dad was like, look, it wasn't, you're not selling out. If anyone sold out, it was your ancestors, because you use an English language. I mean, you're not like writing it in Sanskrit or something, you know? And so he was like, I don't know what your hang up is, you know, change it, don't change it, do whatever you want, but don't get hung up on it. Like, so I ended up changing it.
Advice you have when you have you booked up because your father. I mean,
I never changed it legally. Like my passport, you know, is I just never really bothered, you know. And it, you know, it depends. Like if I have to sign something legally, you know, I use that spelling. But if I do now, I do a lot of television or stuff, you know, I use the GOTHAM thing, especially because I work in also like the comic book industry. You know, it's like one of the things I do. So yeah, so people think like it's super cool and like, you know.
But I want to ask you, I want to get back to the shift that you talked about from like the South Asian identity to what now you're calling a more American identity. But I want to ask, I read an interview that you did with Oprah.com when you were starting Help Desk, which I wanted to, that sounds like such a cool thing. And you said like you made an effort to, or I don't know if it was a conscious effort, but to talk about where Gotham, G-A-U-T-A-M, where that came from, because it seemed like a lot of people assumed that it was Batman or something. Yeah. But you went back and you took to educate, like, no, this is the first name of Buddha, and that it means the enlightened one, and you lifted it up. And I to me, that means something, as, you know, as someone who, you know, struggled with an Indian identity growing up in Florida, like, that things that we had weren't lifted. To see someone like that do that was really empowering. Is that something you do consciously? Was that something that happened?
You know, it's a little bit, it's all of the above. Look, when I say I'm American, there's a certain pride in that, or I guess, but there's also no lack of pride. I mean, I never, you know, and I say this with hopefully as much humility as possible, but like, I was always proud of my South Asian. I never really struggled with it because I had a very strong South Asian community that I grew up with. In Massachusetts, like, my parents were part of a wave of of immigrants that all came together in the early 70s, and like literally they all came within weeks of each other, and we grew up together. There's a whole bunch of kids I grew up with. Like, yeah, the school I went to, you know, I was one of like maybe two or three South Asians, and honestly, like, you know, we were friendly, but I sort of quickly became friends with, because I was always like an athlete in sports. I dealt with all the stuff that I'm sure we all dealt with in terms of like, you know, dealing with, I went to predominantly Irish Catholic school and stuff like that.
Right.
But there was never outward racism or anything. It's just, you know, cultural assimilation. So I've always felt very comfortable. I also had the incredible fortune of going back to India constantly. Right. Like, I never went more than 2 years my entire life, even till now, without being back in India. So I've always felt comfortable in either place. You know, in fact, if there's anywhere I feel sometimes not comfortable, and not, I don't want to say not comfortable, but not entirely, you know, assimilated, is in India. Right. You know, I always like to say I'm Indian everywhere in the world except for India. Like, as soon as I go back there, I'm so clearly American. I think in terms of, you know, now it's sort of interesting because South Asia, Indianness has become celebrated to absurdity in our Western culture now, right? Like, with the people's obsessions with yoga and chais and, you know. So I do feel a sort of, ironically, almost a need to sort of ground, because, you know, India is not just like, in fact, you know, hot yoga and rock yoga and this yoga and that. That's like not very Indian. Sort of anglicized version of it.
Right.
So yeah, where there are opportunities to sort of, you know, shine the light a little bit on, you know, I don't know, like more of the cultural relevancy of India more accurately. Yeah, I definitely feel somewhat of a obligation or responsibility to do that.
You got this one?
No, go ahead.
The South Asian, the shift to what I'm hearing from you, which is really, I mean, this podcast and what we've been exploring is just this struggle with reconciling those two identities for ourselves. I mean, this is what this whole conversation has been born out of. What I'm hearing from you and what I'm sensing from you is just this tremendous ability to hold space for both. Was that a process? Can you talk about how you do that? Because I feel like that's something I struggle with.
Sure. I mean, I'm trying to think of if there's a real methodology to it. So it's interesting because, you know, I'm assuming I'm probably a good 10 years or so older than you guys, you know.
Go ahead and make that assumption. It's probably not true, but I'll take it.
You know, I again, it's interesting we're talking about Sachin, right? Like, I feel like I'm part of a transitional generation. Like, my parents were very much immigrants in this country, right? Like, I'm first generation. I was born here, right? I'm the first one in my family ever in the history of my family to be born actually outside of India or Pakistan. So I feel a transitional, like when I was growing up, there was very much like my parents' generation were physicians or engineers, right?
Right.
And my generation was the one that sort of came along and started to break that. And it was a big deal. Not so much with my parents, but like with a lot of people of my generation. It's like, if you didn't go to medical school, if you didn't become an engineer, suddenly there was like, well, what's going on? Now, like, I look at some of my younger cousins or just, you know, younger people I know, like, they're everything. Actors, you know, artists, and, you know, they're also physicians, engineers, whatever, but they're everything, and there's less resistance to that. There's, I don't feel as much, and I'm a parent myself now. Like, I look at my kid, whatever he wants to be, I don't have the same hang-ups I think my parents' generation had in terms of being in this country, because I feel much more connected to this culture. And I look around at other sort of, and I look at my wife, she's Chinese-American, her parents, exact same experience, they just happen to come from a different part of the world, but in terms of assimilating. So I think for me, it's just sort of like been a gradual process of growing up in this country and feeling as American as anyone else. I don't know that there's actually been a particular methodology to it, other than to say I like what I like. I'm very proud of all the different aspects of myself. You know, I'm in touch with my culture, I would say, you know, in terms of like music, fashion, films, food, all of that sort of stuff, you know, philosophy, literature. But I'm also, you know, I like to think of myself as pretty global. And I definitely think of myself as a sort of global citizen, you know.
Do you speak Hindi? Is that a part of your life?
I mean, you know, I can cheat my way, you know, along, especially here. Like, again, I go to India and like I try to speak and be like, you know what, let's stick with English. Yeah. You know, like, but you know, I can get away with it. I mean, it is one of the things I wish I spoke it more fluently. My wife speaks Mandarin, you know, mm-hmm. completely fluently. Right. She grew up speaking it with her family. And so she's able now to speak it with my son, and he speaks Mandarin. Right. So I can't really, like, I mean, I can barely.
They're going to talk so much shit about you when they get older.
Yeah. Oh, they already do. So, yeah, I wish I was able. It's one of the things I wish I, you know, I did better, but, you know. Sadly, I don't.
I think I know the answer to this, but do you feel the need to, you are proud to be an Indian, do you feel the need to represent our culture in a certain way when you do projects? I assume you're going to say no, but then you have so many, like, you're doing a Sachin documentary, you're working on a Ramayan update. So is that something that you just think is cool, or do you feel a certain degree of need, like,
I don't feel a real responsibility in that sense. I feel, look, everything I do is really motivated by my passion for it. Like, if it's interesting to me and something I can get excited about, then I absolutely, that's kind of what drives me. I mean, I think what's interesting about like the Ramayana or the Mahabharata, all these different sort of South Asian inspired projects that I'm working on. I mean, first of all, it's all part of a South Asian inspired company. That's kind of the mission of the company. But I just feel like, you know, I guess my responsibility in that regard is like these ancient myths, these incredible cultural mythologies that are part of our ancestry haven't been updated in my view in thousands of years, in centuries, you know. And I feel like, you know, some of these incredibly inspiring stories need to be sort of shared with the world, but in a progressive way. I mean, if you look at the original mythologies of like the Ramayans and the Mahabharata, it's no different than the Old Testament, etc., which is like, whoa, some of this shit is pretty, yeah, you know, out there. And it's, you know, we haven't done a good job, I think, in our culture of adapting these stories and making them relevant to a modern, you know, culture.
So how are you going to update it while staying true to the, is that the challenge? How do you plan on going about that?
I mean, I think you stay true, I guess, to the inspiration of it, or I guess you try to the sort of spiritual element of it. But look, I will say I'm way more concerned. A specific example is Ramayan, for example. Right. You know, Sita is like this incredible character, but she's been portrayed a certain way as the sort of damsel in distress, you know, sort of passed from, you know, her prince Ram over here, or the king, to the demon over here. And she's just sort of like this token, which, by the way, is very familiar to, like, you know, Greek mythology and a lot of that stuff. Now, I think, like, in a modern culture, and when you look at some of the things plaguing India right now, in terms of, you know, what's going on in that country, you know, Sita is a character that needs to really evolve, and it's a responsibility of storytellers to sort of look at the culture that we're part of and sort of create a more empowering character. So that's something we've paid particular, you know, as we've adapted that into this new sort of comic book narrative that we've been creating for the last few years. You know, we've tried to pay particular attention, like, this character needs to be empowered. She needs to make her own decisions. She needs to have a point of view on, like, this madness that she's a part of. So, yeah, in that sense, I feel an incredible responsibility, not because I'm South Asian, but because I'm sort of
human.
And I'm, you know, I think, you know, women's rights, like, these are all issues we should be talking about, thinking about. And India more, you know, India's lagging in a lot of these things. And, you know, I definitely feel a responsibility to sort of have a voice in that.
If I can go back to this transitional generation, because I think that's a really, I mean, one of the things that we've discovered is there was this idea that are we as first generations going to be like this isolated culture, and then the second generation is going to be an entirely different culture because they won't necessarily be as in touch with India or their roots.
They'll just be American.
On some levels, I mean, depending on how, or less. My point is that in this transitional period, I guess what I struggle with is this, what is this India that I'm holding true to?
Mm-hmm.
Especially while what we're talking about, India is undergoing such a massive change. Do you struggle with that at all? I mean, the idea, like, of what is India that you're holding on to?
Yeah, I don't really hold on to any version of India. You know, I go back like every year, if not a couple times a year, and it's changed. I mean, like, literally physically it's changed. Like, the roads are all different, like,
right.
You know.
Right.
But culturally it's constantly changing. And, you know, sometimes our version of, quote, India here, like, you go back to India and it's like they've blown by it, right? Like, you know, they just, it's everything is so different and modern. And look, India is so bifurcated, like, culturally and obviously class, you know, is a huge part of that. There's a super wealthy class, it's super impoverished, there's massively growing middle class. Like, India, like I said before, is a lot of everything and too much of it. Like, it's hard to make sense of. So, you know, we have a tendency, though, to try to codify it and kind of, like, create a sort of definition around it here in this country. But the point, I guess my point is also, it, no matter what we try to do, it's changing. And now I look at, like, my own kid, you know, and one generation, two generation, three generations, it's all going to change. And I look at kids who go to school with my kid, like, you know, they're all mixed marriages and races and stuff like that.
But is being Indian, then, what does it mean? Is it, if it's always changing, does it mean anything outside of just the heritage that you grew up with? Does it mean anything? Is there a specific, I guess that's the question, is, like, is there a set of cultural values? Is there a set of, like, driving, orienting principles? I don't know. Do you see
for me,
that question?
For me, there are a set of, I would say, more spiritual values than cultural values. The culture changes.
Right.
Like, you know, the music changes, the food changes, everything culturally changes. Spiritually, though, I think, you know, I definitely identify myself, while I don't really think of myself religiously as Hindu. If there's anything, I probably feel more Buddhist than anything. But I think spiritually there's a set of values. Like, I look at the world and I say, you know, there's certain energies, there's certain, you know, forces at work, and I feel them inside of myself. And we're talking about Kobe, you know, I look at the world, you know, full of light and dark, and I understand, like, these are different expressions of the same singular force. I try to stay away from, like, God, but if you look at Hindu mythology, for example, right, we have hundreds and if not thousands of different deities. To me, all of those deities represent different aspects of myself. And so, and this is not something I created, this is something that is part of our sort of spiritual ancestry. What a Lakshmi represents, what a Krishna represents, a Shiva, a Ganesh, all of these sorts of things. And I definitely, like, identify with those aspects of myself. I'm somebody, because of my family also, who's probably, you know, has been meditating since I was, you know, 5 years old. I don't look at meditation as, like, some version of prayer that I do, some Hindu thing. I look at it as basically, you know, this ability I have to tap into different aspects of myself, you know, I use mantras, right? And what do those mantras do? They awaken and ignite different parts of myself. So, you know, I don't look at it as some sort of strange religious thing. I look at it more as a spiritual practice that allows me to sort of be the best expression of myself or use those elements. Like, you know, Ganesh is the sort of remover of obstacles, right? If you put your attention on Ganesh when you're going through troubling times, that's what it's for. And then you figure out a way to navigate. So that's my Indianness, you know, this sort of spiritual set of values that I definitely identify with more than any other tradition. I mean,
so let me ask you, we have a few minutes, so I want to throw it to, if you don't mind,
of course,
your next generation. You have a son. He's, as you said, Chindian American.
Yeah.
How do you think about what you want to pass on? Is it just by exposure? Is that the important thing for you? Expose and then let him decide? Are there certain things you're going to consciously teach?
We, as young parents, have consciously made the decision not to force him down any singular religious path. We traveled to India, just got back 2 days ago. While we were in India, we went to the Golden Temple, for example.
Right.
So something we do every time we're in India is we go to some sort of, you know, either a mandir, a mosque, a temple,
right,
try to, you know, that to me is important. And the Golden Temple, so, you know, I'm half Sikh. When I got married, you know, my wife, who sort of comes from a Judeo-Christian background, but same way, would never sort of really identify herself as Christian, really. We decided to get, you know, married in a Sikh, you know, temple, because there's something sort of, you know, like you get married around a book, right? Like the book, right, is sacred. It's like not like you're worshiping any specific God. And so for us, I don't know, there's sort of something about Sikhism that has always been very attractive, you know, and just culturally again. And so going to the Golden Temple, which I've been to before, but, you know, certainly taking your kid there is different. But it was really fascinating. And I think that's sort of the path we've pursued. But the same thing I do here, like we got back on Easter, and it's not like we go to church, but like, you know, we share with him, like, this is, you know, Easter's not just Easter bunnies and Christmas is not just Christmas presents. This is the mythology behind it. And I think that's what we do. I'm always fascinated by the cultural mythology that goes with, you know, religion. I'm not so interested in with the rituals or the dogma that goes with it.
You get to go to China as often with him?
Not really, because my wife, you know, doesn't have any family left in China. Really? So I've been to China a few times, more kind of work related,
right?
And I'm fascinated by it. But no, like, you know, I have so much family in India that's kind of the main reason we go back.
Amazing.
Do you have anything you'd like to tell us about? Any upcoming projects you'd like to plug? Any websites, whatever, Twitter?
Not really. I mean, you know, Graphic India, which, you know, I think is actually very apropos to all the stuff we've been talking about. You know, that's a sort of graphicindia.com. And then the other stuff, like, you know, I had so much fun working on the Showtime thing with Kobe. So that's out there. And, you know, everything else is online. You can find me. And I'm very, like, active on social media. And I love just sort of interacting with people. So Twitter, Facebook, all that stuff.
Where can they find you on Twitter?
Just at Gautam Chopra, GOTHAM. So I'm there, and I love interacting. I love doing this stuff. I would definitely love to do more stuff with you guys.
Oh, well, we're gonna we'd love to have you back, guys. We're gonna drop our discussion episode in a couple days. You know what to do. Hit us up on Twitter, Facebook.
Rate the podcast, subscribe to the podcast, tell friends about it. We need numbers. We need money.
Man.
We're not doing this for you.
That's not true. I'm doing it for you.
We're doing this for checks.
I'm doing it for
He's
y'all.
He's a liar.
I ain't lying shit. As always, I'm Arjun.
And I'm Akash.
We'll catch you in a couple of days.
God bless.